Our guest on the podcast this week, Councillor Gerry McMonagall. Many would know him, of course, as a Sinn Féin politician, member of Donegal County Council, representing the Letterkenny Milford electoral area. Gerry, thank you so much for calling up to us for having a chat.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
How are you?
Oh, good, good.
What's life in politics like?
Oh, look, it's, sometimes it can be hard and challenging. Other times it's rewarding. I never get into it for it to be rewarded. But look, someone who's been involved in the community for all the years that I have, I think it was the next step to do is to become elected representative to try and go in and change things that was happening and make sort of life and the towns and villages that we live in a better place. And look, you can be, sometimes when that's, when I'm finished, I'll be judging that, no doubt.
Mm. Is the finish line in sight?
I don't know.
Is it down to the electorate?
Well, it always is down to the electorate, but I'm enjoying my time. And as I say, it's something I'm really interested in. I engage with a lot of groups and involve a lot of groups. I know what the heartbeat of the community is out there, and I try to represent that as best I can.
You're born, though, in bred in Derry.
Yeah.
What was your early life like in Derry, your family life?
Yeah, look, it wasn't easy. There was nine of us in the house. There was six boys and three girls and mum and dad. So that was 11 in total. I lost a young brother with cystic fibrosis about 1966. He lived for about 4 months. And look, things were challenging then. There was very little work. Dad would have most likely went to England a lot to work. There wasn't much work in Derry. And if you went outside there because you were from a nationalist city, you're sometimes discriminated against. So, yeah, look, we were no different than any other family. I was born in the Craigan and grew up in the Craigan, and we were all the same. We didn't know any better. I wouldn't say we were poor. We were just the same as everybody else. We got on with life. We enjoyed life. I loved my childhood. Mum and dad gave us what they could. And the siblings, the brothers and sisters, we have a great bond to this day, and the many friends that I grew up with, I can go into Derry now and just take up a conversation with them. Such was the friendship and the camaraderie, what call it what you will, what we grew up with. So yeah, there was no airs and graces about anything. We were on the same boat, and it was tight, I'm sure, for mum and dad, but we wanted for nothing.
They made do, and
we all made do. And look, we're in a good place today.
So life as a Catholic then at that time, politically, you would feel corralled into your corner then. Is that how it felt? So in other words, if you stepped out of that space.
Oh, without a doubt. You know, I remember distinctly one time when I talked about dad and work. My mum and dad have since passed on. But I remember he got a job in Belfast in the shipyard. And that was great news in our house because it was a long-term employment. And away he went. And on that Monday morning at 6:30, and he was back in the house around 12:30 or 1:00, where he was put off him and three other men that went with him, his friends, were put off the job because they were Catholics. And so there's that discrimination, and we grew up with that. If around the 12th of July, if you're wearing a green pair of trousers or a green jacket, you weren't allowed into the town. The town centre was effectively sealed off. There was barricades, armed soldiers, search people. If you'd go into your town centre, you had to go through turnstiles and be searched and all. So growing up, it wasn't the same as growing up in a lot of other towns like Letterkenny or Donegal Town or anywhere else down here, but in the north, like we grew up with that.
And regardless of even what the numbers were, then you would have felt like a minority.
Yeah, very much so. And there's no argument. The facts are there. The statistics, the Catholics were discriminated against. And the city I was born in, it was gerrymandered to suit the unionist minority. So all the facts, and it's there. It's there to be seen. The whole thing around the university, which probably was the catalyst for the civil rights movement, it was the final straw, being located in Coleraine, and that where it wasn't actually should have been in the second largest city in the six counties, which is Derry.
That was really that has far more political significance in your view than many might realise.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you explain a bit more as to why that would have?
Well, you know,
in the day,
it was around opportunity again, and as we all know, education is a great leveler, and it opens up so many doors for you when you get that education. And to be continually discriminated against, and then all of a sudden you were getting an expectation that a new university was being built and would be built in Derry. And then at the last minute that was pulled from under you and it was relocated in a strongly unionist area like Coleraine. That just said it all, that, you know, we were definitely second class citizens. And I think for people then who were at that time and maybe involved in politics, or they said, you know, we need to do something about this. And I think that was the catalyst for the civil rights movement. You know, the people started speaking out more. They started then protests more, the one man, one vote. Everything else just sort of lined up behind that. Mm-hmm. Because if you refuse education, then you refuse the pathway to life.
And that was so blatant. It wasn't a feeling. It wasn't a sense. It wasn't an experience. It was a bricks and mortar reality.
Yeah, and that come at a time when Derry, which was a major port, was in decline. The investment was taken away from it. And I might have been young at the time, but I could see the decline of the Derry port. You know, we could see the ships coming in regularly, the cattle, the grain, you know, the timber, the coal. And all of a sudden that just started getting smaller and smaller and less and less.
Then that drives unemployment as well.
That drives unemployment. Yeah. And then your pathway to future employment, like university being located, then being taken away from you. I, when you look back and things, you know, all right, civil rights started, one man, one vote. I can remember that. You know, I can remember the marches, remember Mum and
there's
Dad.
A kernel somewhere, isn't there, that starts it
there's,
all?
There's something, and I think that's what started it.
You know, we've got phrases like just transition now, so whether it's you're talking about, you know, farming, it's into something else, or and this was must have felt like just an abandonment. In other words, you know, we really don't matter.
No, that was it. And it was about making it as hard as possible for nationalists to access that further education. The education really made a difference, you know.
Who was as your recollection, and you don't speak for an entire community or whatever, I'm really asking you, at what point did you, at what age were you getting a sense of, you know, maybe frustration or anger or, you know, sort of an awareness of the political situation?
I was quite young, you know, 12 years of age. I mean, I remember 1969, when the Bogside and the riots started in 1969, that at the top of our street, which would be the Craigan Roundabout, that was like a station for servicing the rioters down the bog. They would come up and they would get crates of petrol bombs. Men, women and children were filling milk bottles, sticking rags in them, put them in the milk crates. A van would call up, you'd load up the van, have a go back down. We were standing up from the Craig and you could look straight down the bog side and you just seen gas canister after gas canister being fired.
And what did you feel was happening then? Because what we kind of see now sometimes, and it's not unique to the North or wherever, even in Dublin recently, actually, just to, so people don't think I'm talking about the people of Northern Ireland. But do you know how there can be a spark that fires, you know, public disorder, and next thing you know, people who just fancy messing about start messing about, right? You know, yeah. We've seen that, setting buses on fire and all that kind of stuff. And it does happen in the North too. But it was obviously more organised and there was a cause at that time. Is that the case? And just as a 12-year-old, what did you think you were involved in? Like a war or a... just try to get an insight into what it was like as a 12-year-old.
When you think back and look at it and you look around, because you were looking around and Mrs. Brown, Mrs. Gallagher, Mrs. McMonagall, yes. Mrs. Doherty, you know, their sons and daughters, which were the same age as you, were all involved in this. It was a community. You look around, you're going, good God. My mother's pouring stuff into milk bottles. And, yeah. You know, and it was just, you know, the community, I think that was...
A community pushback?
Yeah. That they just says, oh, we have to make a stand here. Yeah. And then it was the RUC backed up by unionists, who were attacking the bauxite, and the barricades went up, and all the men who were of any age, you know, and allowed, were down there and defending the barricades and keeping the police out. And because the year before we had an experience in the bauxite where the B specials and the REC come in after the march from Belfast, the Darien, which was attacked at Burntollet. When they arrived at the Guildhall that night, the REC and the B specials invaded the bauxite and kicked in doors and smashed up windows. And we all know that Sammy Devaney was killed around that time by the REC kicking in his door and battering him, and he died as a result of his injuries a month later. So, you know, the community had risen at that stage.
And something was building all the while, then, obviously, in every major event, every high profile figure that was taken out, every young fellow that was dragged from a home, this was doing.
You see, well, even at that time, there was no, what you could say, you know, the nationalist leaders were starting to appear. They were starting to come out of the community. You know, it looks at John Hume, Ivan Cooper, yet the civil rights leader who were members of the Republican clubs, as they were known then and all. But leaders were starting to appear. People were standing up and speaking. You know, Bernadette Devlin, you know, and her stance in Derry was just unreal. And what she stood for and what she said was what everybody thought. So, you know, that's there was a sense that we're being listened to. We have the right people in the right place. And that's the way people.
And do you think the sort of the voices, the figureheads of this movement, did they come from the community response? Did the community response follow these people, you know, putting words to how people were feeling, or did it organically kind of happen at the same time?
Yeah, I think it was both. You know, they could get a sense of the feeling. They understood the discrimination that went on. They understood the need for change. And it's like everything else, you seize your moment. And the moment then was seized, the British government intervened. They started looking at the six counties and saying there's something desperately wrong here, and we need to try and fix it. Unfortunately, as things evolved, they went about that the wrong way. But at least then there was a sense of a feeling that, you know, we can make things better for ourselves. Mm. Because up until then, you know, and people here might not understand it, but nationalists were really discriminated against. And we're trodden on. We were penned in like animals, and three and four families, they won house. And I mean, when you think back and you think today where we are today, and that was only 50 years ago.
Is that why do you think there is such sympathy? Again, I'm not saying absolutely everyone, but there is this perceived sympathy with the likes of Palestine amongst the Catholic stroke Republican community, because and I've spoken to a historian about this, you know, experiences like that, they don't just die with the person. They sort of, you know, hundreds of years down the line, the impact of what people went through in a particular place will be shown in their descendants, even if they've never fully felt it themselves.
We can understand all of that. We feel it. We feel their pain. And it's just like there was a news program last night where they spoke to the mothers of those school children who were killed in Iran on the first strikes by the Americans, and you straight away identify with incidents that happened here and happened in our town in Derry, where mothers lost their children due to plastic bullets or being shot of the term crossfire at the time. So, you know, the whole Bloody Sunday escapades, you know, people, you know, out marching for their civil rights and being shot down in the street. So we can understand what they tried to do and what they're doing in Palestine, what they're, you know, and I'm not saying the Iranian regime is great, but the ordinary people in Iran are suffering as a result.
Yeah, well, those school children were not Iranian leadership by any stretch. And there's an awful lot of talk about collective punishment and all that type of stuff, right? So I think people will get that out. So obviously at 12, right, 12, 13, whatever the age might be, you have to be acutely aware of what's going on. Does that mean you have to grow up quick, or is there some strange scenario whereby, you know, if you fall over and cut your knee, you still want to go and sit in your mum's lap, but at the same time, you know, if a crate of petrol bombs need loading, you can do that too.
Yeah, and look, and we led normal lives too. I was into football big time. I played football from morning to night. as did my brothers, my friends. But then there's these other things going on in the background, and it drew your attention now and then. But we still had normal lives as such. I remember, there wasn't much at that time, but we used to do, in the summertime, bus runs to Malin Head or Buncrana, you know, get a day away, and the whole street would get under the bus and we'd go. And there was all that community spirit, camaraderie, and there wasn't a door locked. Every house had a door, a key and a door, and you could in and out, and you could get your dinner and three doors up, and somebody else from three doors up could get their dinner in your house. You know, that's the way it was. We grew up in that really solid community, you know, and where we all stood by and looked after one another. But we still had other lives. We still went and climbed trees and fell out of them, yeah. And you know, and done things like that.
Who would anger have been directed at in your mind sort of at that time? Was it, you know, the British, the monarchy, the police force, or the RUC, you know, the Protestant community?
Well, funny, the Protestant community, my grandfather is actually Protestant and lived in the Fountain Estate,
yeah,
in Derry, and he turned a Catholic to marry my granny, who lived 200 yards away from him in just the Lecky Road area there. And they just, I mean, there was nothing going on there. He was a former British soldier, served in the British Army. And they met up, and when he married her, my granny and Nelly, and become a Catholic, he was disowned by his family.
Mm.
Now, we never registered any of that, wouldn't it? But that news would have filtered through, and from the time him and granny got together and married, none of his family ever darkened our door, spoke to him up until his death, and till he died in 1972.
Mm.
And one of the sisters contacted mum and said, would it be okay if I come up and visit the wake? And mum says, of course. She came up and visited the wake and paid her respects and said, very sorry for not coming here long before this. I hope our Willie forgives me. And away she went into the car. We never seen her from that day to this. Fortunately, she's passed on now too. But, you know, the Protestant community, no, it was never about the... Because when we were at school, we used to play football again, and soccer, like, against the Protestant schools in the Derry City District League. And at a primary school and secondary school, we played. It never went, never came into it with the Protestant community as such. The RUC were the public face of problems that we had because they enforced it. And they were 82-83% predominantly unionist background, Protestants. And they upheld the state. They upheld the discrimination, the gerrymandering, the bias, the, you know, against nationalists, and they were probably the cold face of it, and the people that you resented the most.
I mean, obviously, the easiest question in the world to ask you was, you know, what were you involved in criminally, if anything? Were you a member of the IRA? Clearly, pointless questions, because whether you are or not, it's like asking Jerry Adams. The answer is obviously no, because such is the way we are now, the situation. That would be like walking to a court of law, putting your hands up and saying blah, blah, blah. So I'm not saying that implies you were or you weren't, but just in case people say to me, why don't you ask him that? It's a pointless, futile, maybe if you're on your deathbed, God forbid, I don't know. But at this point, it's a pointless gotcha kind of a question. So we'll avoid that. But like, as you mature in your teenage years, into your 20s, there must be a pressure. And you know how to talk about this. There must be a pressure to become part of the army now, you know, be it the IRA or active or whatever it might be. I presume every young lad and girl, potentially, that pressure was on, that expectation potentially was there.
Yeah, look, growing up, like thousands of other young nationalists were involved in riots. I mean, sometimes it was a daily basis. And you have to imagine what it was like living where we were. Our houses were being raided regularly. The houses were being wrecked. You don't need to wreck. You don't have to overturn a chest of drawers or kick in the plasterboard on a wall to see if anything's inside it. You can do it properly. Nobody ever objected. Well, you couldn't object to them coming in to raid your house. But so that led to a lot of rioting and all of that there. Look, we were, I joined Sinn Féin at an early age. I'd have been involved in now for over 50 years. And I make no apologies for that. It was the right thing to do. And I agitated. I was a recording activist all my life. You know, and I will be to the day I die, because it's about representing and standing up for your community and helping them. And it's about resisting what was then and getting opposed in us, which was British rule. And if you look at the conflict in the North, and, you know, I mean, civil rights, everybody had the right to go and stand up and protest for peacefully. And look what happened to us. We were battered off the streets. And when that didn't deter us, when we continued to protest and march for civil rights, shadows on our streets. And then, you know, that never deterred it. We had AM, we found all our ways, and it was about getting involved. And I was a strong advocate of getting involved in electoral politics, because I could see that's the way, you know, we could effectively make change.
Would that have been where you saw elective politics as the path?
I'd say I was in my 20s at this stage, you know, because we come through and you sit and watch things. You do a lot of reading of books and looking at other things and studying the forum. I looked at the representatives that were supposed to be representing nationalists, and no disrespect to them, but they weren't effectively representing
us. Hypothetically, with everything that you went through, like, if you had gotten a call, would you have answered that call?
Well, the call was there. I answered the call. You answer the call in whatever way you can. As I say,
but yours was a political answer.
I'm a Republican activist all my life, and I will be to the day I die. And I choose whatever way I want to do that
of
there.
Of course, yeah. And Paul McLaughlin often talks about he had a fork in the road, and there was two options.
Yeah.
One was to go out and be a member of the IRA or whatever, and the other was with politics. And he's very clear that he chose that political route. Did you have much trouble with the police force up until you being lifted in 82? Like, were you a prominent enough figure whereby, you know, you'd be a good one to hassle?
I've been like, you don't have to be prominent to be arrested. We were getting arrested.
But you do to some extent, but you had above the parapet.
We were getting arrested all the time. We were get detained at roadblocks, get detained on the street. We were arrested. I mean, getting taken to Strand Road RUC station.
How did you treated in there, for an example?
Not very well. Yeah. And you'd be there for days, getting interrogated, 3 days. Sometimes then they introduced 7 days detention, but you were treated well. You were slapped about, you were threatened, you were coerced, you were told.
But that all built up more and more anger. It's like, sorry to use the sort of the Iranian situation again, but and Iraq and everything else, particularly the USA, in trying to achieve the change that they're trying to achieve for whatever reason, the recruitment campaigns effectively. And you know, treating a whole community like that, it is a recruitment campaign. I'm not talking literally about recruitment, but I mean, you're going to, how many times can you get knocked about in a police station before you say, right, you know, enough is enough?
Yeah, that's just it, you know, and this is what they could never understand, you know, and they talk about, you know, oh, we should have got round the table and spoke. I mean, Republicans were always open to discussion. They discussed how we should proceed. We had a position where,
was that united though? Because I am conscious, and this is this is not like the normal format we might chat in, because this is your story, and there'll be conversations, and there have been conversations with members of different communities into the future. But you are painting obviously the Catholics as the victims completely, the good guys. We're always ready to talk. Is that generally is that genuinely how you feel it was, or is that you with sort of rose tinted glasses on, if you get what I mean?
No, it's not rose tinted glasses. I'm trying to set out why nationalism rose up because of how we were being treated. And then there was governments there that could address those concerns and change the way we were being treated, and they choose not to. Then they get into diplomatic. They decided who to talk to. The conflict began, and then instead of trying to resolve it through talking, they brought in draconian measures like internment, shoot to kill, the whole thing around the supergrasses, then the criminalization policies that led to the hunger strikes. And yet in 1972, they actually lifted the likes of Gerry Adams out of internment camps and took him to London with Martin McGuinness and other Republican leaders of the time. So Republicans were always willing to talk. It was English presence and how they governed the six counties of our country was the issue. Mm. And they would never face up to that. And the same happened in 75. The same happened in the late 80s and then the 90s, where the British government had no problem talking to senior figures in the Republican movement who were involved in conflict, but they would never come to the solution and face up to it. And thankfully that they started looking at things differently in 98.
And do you think the bombs and the killings, and I'm not saying it even justifies that, but is that what do you think brought the British to the table? Like when it sort of, I mean, obviously, particularly when it was on their own doorstep.
I don't know if that's what brought it to them, because they had ample time to sort this out before it got to that stage. They had, they had the ability to bring everybody together, talk about it. Why wait 25, 28 years, over almost 4,000 deaths, multiple injuries, 40,000 through the jails before you come to a solution? I mean, it's not that Republicans are intransigent. As I say, the evidence is there that where the Republican movement was willing to discuss settlement.
You talked about prison there, early 80s, 82. You were lifted for the murder of Hugh Lexi Cummings. You had moved to Strabane at that point, had you?
Yeah, I was married to the Strabane girl. I moved to Strabane late 70s, and I was living there. I first went to jail, and I was arrested there, and just thought it was another arrest and detention. And then while
slap
I was
you around a bit, then
yeah, place, yeah, and while I was there, it was a different. There was actually detectives from London who interviewed me. Just thought, what's going on here to myself? But they started talking about Bertie Small, who was a criminal apparently in London, and how he had turned supergrass. And this was a new weapon they were going to use against people like me and other Republicans. And I was just sitting there at a loss what it meant. But anyway, at the end of the 3 days, they said you were taking you to court. This stage, because they had put to me, Supergrass had made certain statements against me, and during one of those 3 days, a door opened and some person was standing there. I just got a brief, I couldn't see who it was, and I just seen him nodding his head, and that was identifying me, apparently. And we were washed off to Crumlin Road Jail.
So the only evidence against you at that time was, I presume, is that an alleged eyewitness that nodded?
Yeah, someone
and
who...
the evidence of a supergrass, and that was it?
Yeah, and...
did you have any involvement in that instance?
No, yeah. And about 5 months later then, this person, I know the person now, but withdrew the statements he had made against me and others, and we were released. And the reason why he gave the statements, because he actually come and visit me after he was that he was getting immunity from what he had done.
So
if he named a number of other people, which he did do, and when he withdrew his statement, his immunity was taken away from him and he got 12 years in jail.
Wow. So there'd been no scrutiny of his evidence other than him saying it was Jerry Mack, it was this person, it was that person, that was it, and that was enough with the legislation that had been enacted. That was enough for you to spend a year in the nick.
Yeah, and I mean, 6-7 years later when he got out of jail, he knocked on my door one Boxing Day, and it was the gentleman standing there, and he apologized to me and he explained to me what happened. And when the day after he withdrew the statements, he was put back into jail, because at that time he was outside of it.
But he did go to trial.
He went to trial.
Yeah, you didn't.
No.
Yeah. And that is the basis for all this on the run stuff as well, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So why were you not exonerated then?
Well, I was exonerated there, but
you were rearrested.
I was well. I was arrested for the alleged killing of the gentleman he named there. Yeah. It was UDR, a British soldier, and again, had no hand, act, or part in that. There was what they said was some sort of forensic evidence. I was 20 odd months in jail. I went to the trial, and at the trial, I was found not guilty. And I was released by the judge because there was insufficient evidence. And I was immediately rearrested and charged with the exact same offence. I was taken across the town to our courthouse in Belfast, and I had no representation. And I was actually shouting from the doctor, the magistrate, I've just been released from Belfast City Commission courthouse. And the policeman who arrested me says, he's telling lies. And the magistrate says, I don't know who's telling the truth. So he just remanded me for a week. The following week, I was brought up again to the remand court. And at this stage, I had my barrister and my solicitor were present. They asked for the evidence, told the magistrate that it had been released because there was no evidence. And the director of public prosecution says they asked for an adjournment till they would get the arresting officers and the people who had the so-called forensic evidence, they come up and give it. And so I sat all day down the stairs in a cell in the courthouse, and at the end of that day I was brought up and nobody turned up. No policemen come to give evidence, no forensic scientists come to give evidence. And the magistrate says, if you have no evidence, I can't hold this man, and they released me. And they went to rearrest me again. And I was pushing at this police REC sergeant to let me go. The barrister intervened and said, why are you detaining this man? And then, because it was a barrister with a wig on and all that, he let me go, and I went. And I then spoke with my briefs following days later, and they said, it doesn't look like they're going to give you a time of day. And I says, well, to myself, you have a young family. And
so how long did you stay
in Donegal?
Yeah, so after your final release, how long did you hang about in the north before you crossed over into Donegal?
About 4 days.
But the sense was is that they're just going to pick you up for this again.
Yeah.
And was it lack of evidence, or was it, I read somewhere that it was about legal papers and the signing of legal papers that was the issue?
Well, I mean, if that's what it was, but what I know is that I had no hand, act, or part in it.
No, of course I understand that.
And I was getting put there on this so-called forensic evidence.
So let's just presume that evidence was there, not that it was accurate, but that sitting on a file somewhere and you've never had the opportunity to scrutinise it or defend yourself. I mean, that is effectively still hanging over you, is it? Well, like, has it ever been expunged or case closed, or have you ever been released from the investigation, so to speak? Do you know what I mean? So that you know exactly where you are.
Well, there's been two chief constables at the REC in recent years have said, because it's a public case, it's in the public domain, people have been raising this case, the DUP bit pathways to the door of Stormont for years about this. I've lived openly. No one's ever come and arrested me, and whether extradition or whatever, it was all there for them to do that if they wished.
So when this on the run list appeared,
the two chief constables said that there was no evidence to get a conviction. There was insufficient. Yeah. So you know.
So that's what I'm saying. So in the early noughties, then when your name appeared in an on the run list, were you like, what do you mean? Like, did that come as a shock to you?
It was a shock, but it was a welcome shock. And I'm saying, well, if I can get travel, because up until that stage, I could not go home. Yeah. My father passed away in 1986 with cancer. And he was in hospital for the last 3 months of his life.
In Derry,
in Aldergalvin. And me and Dad were quite close. I'm the oldest in the family, and we had worked together and all of that there. And it really annoyed me that I couldn't go in. And then I said I was going in, and then Mum got very annoyed at this. And I said, look, I need to go and see him. And so we've done phone calls, and it's not the same. Like,
no, you missed out on what would have been some of the most important time for your dad.
Yeah.
And if there was anything that needed to be settled,
yeah,
it was
yeah, that was the time. Yeah. You know, and so no, look, so they can't have everything that they want in ways that, you know, you're innocent, but we think you're guilty. You know,
so what did on the run status give you then in terms of, you say, well, at least I know now. Did that mean, can you travel into the north? Can you travel to England, Britain? You know what I mean? What does that actually
mean?
And does it still apply to you? I presume it does, yeah.
You couldn't travel to and home, obviously, and you couldn't travel to Britain. I went to Europe, France in particular.
I'm not cutting across you, Jerry. It's just some of this stuff's really interesting. I'm just curious, when you say that, do you just go, I'm going to Europe, or do you have to check with, you know, do you have to party check with authorities, or is it simply booking a flight, or is it you have to double check and cross check everything?
Well, you look and say, right, is there a possibility that you could be arrested and extradited? Yes, there is that. Does it happen? No.
Mm.
Why should it happen? No. Why? No. There was no proceedings against me here because there was no evidence. I was innocent, and you know, people accepted that here. But the people in the military, or whatever you want to call them, in the REC, they thought they had somebody, and that was, they wanted off the streets, and they did, and they effectively got me off the streets of where I lived. And you know, obviously, I was a thorn in their side. I was agitating it. Like, we remember that time was the hunger strikes, and I was chair of the hunger strike committee in West Tyrone at the time. I was in contact with Donegal, and we were organizing marches. I organized a lot of protests in the Strabane area. I was just, you know,
they wanted to take the head of the local snake eventually.
Yeah, you want to get rid of you, and at any means possible.
I'm skipping over a bit when we come back. You'd every now and again you'd pop up in the Nationals. 2017, I think, you were mayor then.
Yeah,
went up to meet Leo Varadkar in Derry. How controversial was that for you at that time?
It wasn't one bit more controversial than me being along with a Finn Gael t-shirt. Yeah. You know, but that was my role. And to be honest,
it still was a calculated risk. Was it a calculated risk?
No, look, I'll tell you, if we go back a bit in 1999, 2000, after signing the Good Friday Agreement, there was ex-prisoner projects being set up. And I was instrumental in helping to set up the one in Donegal. I then went in 2002 to work for A While You Reach Here in Donegal.
Mm.
And during my time in working with A While You Reach, I met with former RUC, current RUC, former guards, current guards, former British soldiers, current serving British soldiers, loyalists, ex-prisoners, loyalist leaders. We had a number of conferences here where we had people from the PUP come down and speak. Former combatants spoke at them. Former members of the British Army spoke at them. So I was out there meeting them. We were building the peace process. So I was traveling regularly. I was in as part of the policing in the community where the Gardaí, the PSNI as it was then, and Republican ex-prisoners were meeting with guards, the PSNI.
Yeah,
and it was about building you know, on that relationship.
So
I was in the Strand Road barracks.
Right, okay. So there was ample
meetings with them.
Yeah.
And
so when you see this newspaper coverage, you're thinking, hold on a second, you're a bit late to the party here. So just two more questions in relation to that, and then we'll move on. But it is a significant part of life, and it's a significant part of history as well. But see all those people that you met. There was a time, if you'd have met REC reps or PSNI reps or even members maybe of you know, the other side of the house, so to speak, that there'd probably been anger or hatred, or you'd almost not spat at them, but you know what I mean. At what point in the intervening time did that anger subside, or that you, I say anger, it's probably different emotions, I don't know, where that would facilitate you to be able to share the same air as these people? Was that with your age, or was that maybe that process helped in you doing that? I don't know.
The whole process, I think the want and the need to resolve the conflict, and you have to have difficult conversations with people who are involved in that conflict, and you have to get all of those people onto or near the same page. Now, I'll never agree with the British Army's position in Ireland, or indeed the REC, but I can understand it more because I've listened to what they're saying, where they come from, how they viewed us as Republicans. And we were in very difficult conversations. We were in rooms where that there was counsellors available after the discussions, and some people availed of them because such as some of the trauma that was raised during them discussions, because we went down to the bone on it. Because that's what you have to do.
And it was people with lived experiences.
It was people with lived experiences from all sides.
Not just reading a book and having an understanding of history.
And I remember that one of the last meetings I had was with six former RUC personnel. And all of them, there's three of them had limbs off. All of them had been shot or blew up. And having a conversation with someone that they seen as a Republican, who was probably, they would have seen where I come from was responsible for doing this. But they were very gracious in it. Because during the intervening years, they had got the talk and explain.
There was but more understanding on both sides.
Yeah.
Even though they carried.
Yeah, I understood where they were coming from. And I shared, I said, look, nobody wanted to be doing these things. And they likewise understood, because I was able to say, well, where we come from, how it's, was instilled in us, the people we lost.
Yeah.
I lost many friends, as did a lot of people, but it was only through them hard conversations that we are today.
Yeah. Finally, on the run letter thing, it's not even for you at this point, but just for is it not a badge of honour as such? Are you happy for that to just sit there, or would you welcome a mechanism that would completely release you from that?
Look, I can go wherever and whenever I can. I have no problems. Look, on the run letters, it doesn't matter to me.
Aye, but
it's a piece of paper.
Exactly.
No, so the important thing is that we've moved on, and there's an understanding of where we've come from, and that we have to. We can't keep thinking back and looking back to the past. I certainly the truth recovery stuff and all that. Yeah, let's go and do that. Let everybody who's been involved in it, but be at the table, and that's important. You just kind of be selective in that.
I mean, obviously, you've been politically involved with Sinn Féin for a long time and on the same path as the party is perceived to have been on or has been on. But you might also be seen sort of as a connection to the past, and you've lived, you've got representatives now that have learned what you lived in school books and all that kind of stuff. Are you happy and content just to see where the party goes now, or do you keep a strong eye on the direction of it? And if you've got concerns, that you'll express them.
Yeah, look, I always do. We go back to the years leading up this, the Good Friday Agreement and the agreement that was made. I was in the Ardchóir Sinn Féin that time, and it was you just get your eyes open to what was going on and the extent of the discussions. And the papers that was coming in and having to go through and look at, and Martin McGuinness, Gerry Adams, Pat Doherty here in Donegal, who was, most underestimated politician in Ireland. That man there is
big hitter.
He's has foresight, has vision, has the understanding of doing getting things done. And his empathy is just, for me, come from Donegal as well, it was a great understanding. That's someone you could talk to any day of the week. And if you had an issue. And so, you got to learn about why you do things, and you have to have a long game. And it's not based on party. It's based on everybody.
Sort of, we talked a little bit earlier on about sort of empathy for minorities, be it in this country or in the Middle East or wherever it might happen to be. And that empathy is born from experience. But then you sort of see, and I'm not getting into a big political discussion, Gerry, but don't get me wrong, but then you see sort of as elected power in the Republic gets closer, you sort of sometimes start seeing Sinn Féin go, well, how separate are you from Fianna Fáil in certain things? And some of the commentary can be quite reactionary in terms of immigration and all that kind of stuff. And I would look on and observe, and I wonder, is that, you know, the people that know what, on whose shoulders this party was built on, is it losing its way at all? Do you have any concerns in that regard?
No, you know, I mean, we're built on the shoulders of the people with no property. You know, it's about looking. I under the immigration, I think we've been totally misrepresented. You know, to be honest, the far right have done a fairly good job on us. I think, you know, if I'm being honest, that we were slow to put our position out there. And we're not for open immigration, far from it. You know, but we're for a proper immigration policy.
Yeah, but I think in terms of some of the commentary and what Sinn Féin might be for, it I think actually goes perhaps to, you know, for some within Sinn Féin too far. Is really what I was saying. It's not that you're over, like I was coming to that point of the question that Sinn Féin's position has moved really quite closely to, you know, the further right.
No, I don't think so. You know, the government, you see, who the immigration policy was adopted and put in place by, is getting away with the disastrous policies that they brought into place and the lack of enforcement. But for some reason, and I think this is where people were looking to Sinn Féin to show more leadership. And I think initially, as I said, I think we're a bit slow, but I think we've got our act together in that. I think we're getting it out there. The far right have nothing to offer the people of Ireland or anywhere else. You know, all they're doing is promoting racism and division. And look, this country's big enough, and we look. I think there's about 9,700 Ukrainians in Donegal. There's 2,200 IPAS. You would think that we were overrun.
Yes, but that's because.
And if we look, the reason why them people are here.
Congregation as well. It's where and how they've been housed, I think. And then obviously that can be monetized by.
It's going back. And we look at the people who made millions out of this. You know, and why? Because government policy, again, enabled that.
As we record this, I don't know when people will be listening to it down the line. Marilyn McDonald is the leader. She had a good crack of the whip at it. There was a point there where, you know, this message of change was, it seemed to be the party was just about to make that breakthrough. And then there was a couple of policy announcements. And I think regular people kind of thought, better the devil, you know, there is the change there. Is it time, do you think, or are we getting close to the time where, you know, a Piers Doherty or, you know, there's no end of names, actually. And I won't even start and mention Piers because he's local here. Or even a Padraig, but most likely Pierce, I would say, in that leadership role. Is it time to, especially a couple of years out from an election, to give someone else another crack at it, do you think?
Well, look, you always keep things under review. Personally, I think Mary Lou is doing a good job.
But that's a good job at holding steady if you're looking to.
Yeah, and kick I think. On. I think
we'll be is she the woman to kick on, like, from where you're at?
Well, look, I know my experience of her is that she's not afraid to take decisions. Mm. Sometimes you think, well, you should, you know, listen a bit more at times. But she is a true leader in that regard, that she sees a vision and she goes with it. And she brings people along with her when she's going to move and so on. And that's the right thing to do. I think, unfortunately, for Mary Lou, what happened, I mean, she had an illness in her life that set her back quite a bit. Her husband then was also had an her mother died, and it all seemed to happen at a crucial time in politics. And I think she's recovering.
There was a momentum
build, and all of this happened there, and she is recovering from that now. If I was being looking at it objectively, or you know, I think she's recovering from that now, and she's getting back into her stride again. I'm happy enough with Mary Lou as a leader. There's things that I would disagree with, and a reason I say it there.
It'd be strange if you didn't, but yeah. Overall.
Yeah.
People are very familiar with your time in Donegal and as a councillor here. It was obviously, your desire to become a councillor here, was it because you liked the whole idea of community leadership, being able to affect change? At the earliest days, did you have ambition, you know, maybe to even go further in politics?
Well, look, probably with being the person up front and out there, you're going to be the person that's going to push at the front of the queue, yeah. You know. And in 99, I stood with no, I thought, look, you're talking about electoral politics all the time. You're trying to encourage people to get involved in the party and to, you know, stand for election. So I the first time I stood was in 99, and I thought I got a credible enough vote at that time for someone who was relatively unknown on the political scene. So then I stood in 2004. I made it that was a calculated risk and decision that I made myself personally, and yeah. Says, look, I'm going to stand the town council. We've had a couple of people that hit the bar. And after 99, I got involved in local community in a joint letter, Kenny CDP, and I've been with them ever since.
So. Do you know, that's critical, that, and I think even is to this day and age, because sometimes, and I'm not on about rights or lefts or whatever, sometimes people think that just because you have a certain point of view or you're a certain gender or whatever it might be, you really need to get involved. You have to roll your sleeves up, don't you? It's that contact, and I'm sure all your fellow councillors would agree to a great extent. That is because also too, you get deselected very quickly.
Yeah.
And we've seen cases whereby people that seemed incredibly popular, as soon as they were deemed to have taken their eye off the ball, the public vote elsewhere.
Oh, and that's always, and look,
in it's the not entitlement, you don't get it.
Oh, it's not firmament. You must work for it. I'm a full-time councillor. I don't work now. After a while, I was folded in around 2014. I just went into the county council full-time. And I'm involved in a number of groups and associate, but the Letterkenny CDP for me is a fantastic organisation. We have tentacles all through the community, and we have CE schemes and all of that. And I love working with them and doing what I can, organising in the community, because that's where I'm from and that's where I'm best at. Mm-hmm. And I do that as regular as I can. And the time of COVID, when you know. With the CDP, the good new, God rest Eamon McDivitt and Lynn, the two boys from the cafe down the street, and we met up and says, right, what can we do? We says, right, we need to start doing sort of the Meals and Wheels service, and we put it out there. And we had 50 volunteers at the end of the first week. We were getting donations in through a GoFundMe. We had the Honeypot. They gave us the facility. Their chefs started doing the cooking. And within a couple of weeks, we had 370 meals every single 7 days a week for months. It's during COVID. And it was people from the community. It was, you know, teachers. Mums, dads, old age pensioners, I know they won't mind me saying that, and they come every single day. They got their box, their crate if they had a run, and we had it all mapped out. And that for me was community involvement at its best.
Even you know, when you were high profile and a much younger and a family man, if someone was a newspaper or said what, it was very controllable. You know, once you close the door of the house, everyone's in the house, blah, 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 blah. Nowadays, obviously, you know, we've got social media, and anyone can say absolutely anything, and you're under far more scrutiny. And it doesn't really matter at what level of politics you are. So your ability to protect your family, I think at this stage, anything said about you is like water off a duck's back, right? But there are those around us that you can't always protect from that. Has that ever given you pause to thought about life in public office? That, you know, I don't think you get that much abuse online, or maybe you do compared to some people, right? But you can't insulate everyone from everything now. It's all out there.
No, and you can't. And you do. And I talk to my family regularly about that. But what I would say is all the time I've been involved in family or in politics and family, I suppose, yes. It's the support I've got from my family. Sina has been a stalwart, and, you know, She's there every day, and you go back. If you have a hard day, there's stuff being said about you. She doesn't say no, but she finds the moment and would just suggest something to you. And my sons and daughters, they see it all. My granddaughters now and grandsons who are of an age have an opinion now too. They don't like it. Sometimes they get very upset about it. But it comes with the job. I would just ask people to, I think what it is, and I understand people's frustrations a lot about a lot of stuff. But make your point, but don't personalize it, because it is water off my back.
Yeah.
They haven't got the same access that I've had. I've sat for years along with other councillors, deliberated, took in reports, tweaked and changed things here and there to make a proposition going forward, or a strategy that we believe strongly will be for the benefit of the community. They don't have it. They just start to see barriers going up, or a lane being shortened, the street being dug up for water mains, and it's a hindrance to them and getting about their business. But if they try and look beyond that,
yes, but I don't think that genie can be packed in a bottle, because you've got instant gratification of getting something off your chest.
That's what it does now. And then you want to be part of the crowd. Because a couple of people are putting it up, and that's where you see that with that far right, where they have all these bots and these people putting in things who don't know what they're talking about.
Well, a lot of that comes from, if you see the traffic, it's from outside Ireland, if the truth's been on, and it's a business. Would you recommend, what's your views on anyone close to you going into politics? Would it be something you'd encourage?
Yeah, but none of them contemplated at all.
I was wondering if that's because you've soft influenced them over
the years. I would say this about my family. They would be political. They understand politics. They wouldn't be for
the old sports fan.
I think at times they're critical too. They wouldn't be long and send me a text about something and say, that's wrong.
Yeah.
You need to explain that, and I value that there, but I value the time with the family. It's not often you get time, but I love going on the holidays with them when they were a bit younger, but I love going to events. And I had a son married there last year, and they went to Nerka, which I like Nerka. I've been in it, and it's a lovely spot, but it was great to have all the family together.
Yeah, it's lovely. Those are the precious, precious moments. Yeah. Listen, and you enjoy a bit of cycling too.
I did. Look,
now I'm starting to figure out why you voted for this.
I used to love cycling. I've done a lot of cycling.
I'm only joking, by the way.
I've done a lot of cycling, and it was sort of one of the founding members of the Letterkenny Cycling Club many years ago with a number of other people, Charlie Joe McGinley and all. And we go out regularly, but it becomes so unsafe, Greg.
Yeah.
It wasn't worth the risk. Yeah. And that's why I'm an advocate for.
Shall we not go into that?
I
know what you're saying. So, and what we're talking about, it's a local issue here to Letterkenny. It's active travel, and we're seeing it in different places. Jerry, you would have voted for it, but it's a genuine, for all the ins and outs of it, it's born from your actual packing in cycling because of unsafe roads, effectively. So there you go. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so very much. I mean, obviously, listen, we brushed over your, 26 years almost in local politics. People know you intimately in and out in that regard. And it's just an interesting, I suppose, to learn a little bit more about you and, where you came from. And we really do appreciate your time. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you, Greg.